Hi, welcome to this week's program. In the past, I have spoken about opposing outlooks on whether the market was overvalued and due for a correction, or fairly valued and expected to continue higher. While I've urged older investors to consider taking some profits or getting a little bit more conservative while this all plays out, I urge my younger listeners, so-called millennials or Generation Y, to consider staying invested in the market for the long run and not obsess about a downturn. Because over long investment horizons, stocks have the potential to deliver higher returns than other security classes and have the chance to outperform inflation despite ups and downs in the market. Provided, of course, that past performance doesn't guarantee future results, risk of losing principal is higher with investments that have higher return potential and investors stay invested in the market and don't move their money in and out. Basically, I said ignore all the pundits' advice on market timing. Very important that you listen to those words. Now, millennials or Gen Yers, as they're called, are those who were born between the early 1980s and the year 2000, so they're now in the 15 to 35 age group. These young men and women have most of their working lives ahead of them with retirement 30 to 40 years away. Enough time to potentially accumulate wealth through wise investments and reach retirement goals. In fact, millennials could easily follow simple plans such as investing their savings into a few diversified portfolios such as index funds or ETFs or passively managed portfolios with low management fees. Then, as they reach age 55 or so, they can consider shifting their portfolio from stocks to a combination of, let's say, 50 to 70% stocks and about 30% bonds and rebalance periodically. Through the years, they should consider sticking to their simple plan and largely ignore the financial media and short-term market fluctuations. I'd also urge these younger investors not to panic or sell when the market goes down or buy after the market has already gone up. Consider steadily staying the course and investing in the market each month through ups and downs. I know, following this is way more difficult than it sounds because of all the noise and genuine confusion. Nobel Prize-winning economists such as Robert Shiller are saying the market is ripe for a correction, and investment pros like Warren Buffett are saying the market's just fine. So my tip to Gen Y is to just ignore both sides and stay focused on your goals towards retirement portfolio building. But here's the rub. Gen Y seems rather risk-averse and doesn't have a favorable view of stock investments, and that can really hurt them. For example, in a recent article in U.S. News & World Report by Dan Solon, a wealth advisor, actually was titled, Smart Millennials Can Be Dumb Investors, and its basic premise is exactly that, that this millennial generation is fairly risk-averse and not inclined to put its money in the market. In part because earlier in their lives, they've witnessed the recession of the 90s, the dot-com bust, 9/11, and the recent 2008 financial meltdown, and the severe adverse financial impact these events had on family and friends with lost jobs and foreclosed homes, etc. They've lived the horror firsthand as impressionable young adults, and they blame the stock market for all the misery. I also hope they have paid attention to the incredible rebound in stock prices since 2008 and can now see that volatility itself is not necessarily the end of the world. Dan Solon's article also mentions several studies that show millennials as more materialistic and overly concerned about money, fame, and image, which I guess is understandable because they've grown up in an information-heavy computer and internet age, more influenced by fame, fortune, and social perceptions, with more time spent in front of a computer or TV screens than actually out there playing in the neighborhoods. But as I said, research also shows that many Gen Yers are not into investing and have a basic misunderstanding of risk. Surveys show that almost half of all millennials are opposed to taking any risk with their money and just feel safer leaving their savings in cash, CDs, or bonds. And surveys also show that 70% of them have risk levels that they consider to be moderate or somewhat conservative or conservative. As a result, this generation also has dramatically higher cash allocations, and only 28% of those surveyed say that long-term investing is a major component of their plan to help achieve success. That's compared to 52% for non-millennials. While an all-cash strategy may seem conservative, it's simply not prudent because cash in the bank loses significant purchasing power over time due to inflation. An all-cash portfolio will simply not keep pace with inflation, so millennials need to understand that returns from even a very conservative portfolio may at least keep pace with inflation. So they need to change how they perceive risk, or face a future where they fall short of reaching their financial goals for retirement. Millennials need to understand that not all risk is bad, and that without risk, it's impossible to achieve inflation-beating returns. In fact, oftentimes, millennials, because of this, will fall prey to hucksters who tout investments that offer high returns with seemingly little risk, and such high risk-free returns are simply not possible. So I want to make sure my younger listeners don't fall into this trap and clearly understand that returns are almost always tied to the level of risk you're willing to take. And I want you to embrace a reasonable amount of risk and at least make sure your investments keep up with inflation, again, at the very least. Be conservative, but not overly so, and certainly not to the point where you're standing by and as the purchasing power of your cash in the bank slips away, like sand in an hourglass. And just so you know, there is one glaring exception to the investing attitudes of millennials, tech-savvy employees in Silicon Valley who've embraced investing and are flocking to investment firms that understand how wealth creation really works and help to keep most of those earnings in the pocket of the investor rather than the salesman. I hope more millennials will follow their lead, shed their demons over market crashes past, and take concrete steps towards building a secure retirement portfolio with inflation-beating returns. Are you anxious about your financial future? Have you ever made money decisions you've regretted and then repeated the same mistake again? Or perhaps you avoid talking about money altogether? Life is unpredictable, but your decisions don't have to be. And knowing where you stand and having an ongoing action plan will help you get where you want to go. So when you understand that the cornerstone of success is in making good decisions coupled with deliberate action, you can start on the road to ensuring that you're investing the way you should and feel good that you're taking care of yourself and your family in the best possible way. And you know, this has been the mission of the Steve Pomerantz Show from the very beginning. So once again, I want to remind you that you can ask us anything on your mind financially by visiting stevepomerantz.com. And if you have more serious concerns or questions, I'll personally take the time to get back to you to help you find a solution. I've been helping people do just that for 35 years, helping them get ready for retirement, save for a house or college, and so many of life's turning points. So once again, go to stevepomerantz.com and click on Contact. That's stevepomerantz.com.
Investment advisory services are offered through United Capital Financial Advisors, a registered investment advisor. United Capital and the Steve Pomerantz Show are separate and unrelated companies.
You're listening to The Steve Pomerantz Show. From a meager Frankfurter stand in Coney Island, New York in 1916 to America's most loved and iconic household brand, Nathan's Famous is an icon we all know. My next guest is the grandson of the founder of Nathan's Famous, and he has written the book Nathan's Famous, The First 100 Years, and it chronicles the milestones and centennial history and business strategies of the company's founder, Nathan Handwerker. My guest, Bill Handwerker. Welcome to the show, Bill.
Thank you for having me.
So, Bill, how did it all start? Way back when in 1916 in Coney Island, give us kind of a picture of the way things were back then.
Well, grandfather Nathan came to this country in 1912, not knowing how to speak, read or write. And he was able to overcome that and got into the food service business via a luncheonette, Max's Busy Bee. And in 1914, he went to Coney Island during the summer to try and make some more money, and eventually in 1916, opened up his own restaurant.
The restaurant served what in particular?
He served Frankfurters, French fries, and malted milkshakes.
Mm-hmm. So that was a pretty popular fare back then?
Yes, well, throughout Coney Island, they were selling Frankfurters for 10 cents, mm-hmm. and he felt that in order to grow his business, he had to try something different, and he opened it up for 5 cents, and the rest is history.
Now, I would think he was pretty smart about business, so he tried this 5 cents, but wasn't he worried that people would think that the quality was inferior? Because there's a story in the book about how he got some white coats from the local hospital. Tell us about that.
Yes, well, the competitors were not too happy with my grandfather, and they spread rumors that he was using inferior meats, and that's the only way he could afford to sell it for 5 cents. So he went to Coney Island Hospital, and he borrowed doctor's coats and stethoscopes and gave them to people in front of the restaurant and gave them free franks. And when people passed by and saw that doctors were eating the franks, they said, well, if it's good enough for doctors, it's good enough for me.
Oh, those were simple times, weren't they?
Yeah, you would think so.
Yeah. Now, see, what particularly interests me, and I know there's a lot to this story, we have a limited time. What particularly interests me that I think is important for those of us in business today is that, you know, here he entered a business where there was a lot of competition and he was trying to figure out a way to differentiate himself. So one way he did was through price, for sure, but there had to be more than that. What else was different about Nathan's hot dogs at the time?
Well, I think it was not just the hot dogs, but that he was, you know, he concentrated on the service of it. And I believe that quality of combining quick service and quality food was the difference. And I tell people that I think that my grandfather's stand was really the first true fast food restaurant.
Mm-hmm. So he understood how to make a consistent product in a clean atmosphere and get it to the customer fast. Was there a point in time when, let's say, a movie star or someone famous picked up on it that launched the brand even further?
Well, there was several people throughout the company's history. Right from the get-go, when he was working at Felton's Beer Gardens, Eddie Cantor and Jimmy Durante were singing waiters, and as the story goes, tried to convince him, and they were going to lend him the money to open up his own restaurant and sell it for a nickel. But he did it on his own, and throughout history, from politicos of Nelson Rockefeller, who said, you can't hope to be elected in New York State without eating a Frankfurter in front of Nathan's, to Bobby Kennedy's first run, Barbara Streisand sent them over to London. And the kicker is Walter Matthau had them served at his funeral.
Yeah, so, yeah. Talk about iconic brands and the meaning behind just, you know, your plain old-fashioned, good quality hot dog. So there was more to it, though. When did the hot dog eating contest actually start?
It was in the early 1970s, and yes, in terms of PR, you know, Nathan's reputation was much larger than the actual business, and our monies had to be spent as most efficiently as possible.
Mm-hmm.
So we had these two gentlemen, PR people, Morty Matz and Max Rosie, who thought up the idea they had a client, Hess's department store, and they ran a dog eating contest, and it was successful.
Mm-hmm.
So they thought that if that was successful, how can you imagine how successful a hot dog eating contest would be? And that's how it began.
The book is Nathan's Famous, The First 100 Years, An Unauthorized View of America's Favorite Frankfurter Company. Now, Bill, you worked in the business for quite a while. Tell us about a little bit about your father and your experience working there.
My father, when he came back from World War II, was truly the impetus for the expansion of the company. You know, the generation of my grandparents and that generation of immigrants felt that it was most important to take care of the immediate family and the extended family, and that Coney Island was sufficient. When my father came back from the war, he said, Pop, we have to grow. And that all the GIs coming back are moving out of Brooklyn, a lot were moving out of Brooklyn to Long Island and Westchester and so forth. And it was his impetus to expand the restaurants itself. And going further than that, when I came on board full time, we had just began a major effort in the supermarket program of package frankfurters. And basically, you know, that's how the company grew to where it is today, going through many different gyrations, obviously the ups and the downs. But the bottom line is that the quality of the product is what kept this company going and expanding to where it is today.
You know, you'll find this interesting, but a few weeks ago, I interviewed Patricia Gucci from the Gucci family, and your family's story is very, very similar. There was Guccio Gucci who started the business, very local in Florence. The son, Aldo Gucci, came in after the war, saw the GIs, expanded. It's a very similar story. You may want to get that book to read a little bit about that. Talk about different businesses, but a very common story, perhaps, way back when. Now, things weren't always smooth. You write in the book about something called the Wetson effect. I'd like to know what lessons were learned from that experience.
Well, at that time, my father had growth plans in his mind, and the Wetsons was in the New York market and Connecticut, New Jersey, North Jersey, as really the primary hamburger fast food outlet. And they had troubled times, and we purchased the company, but it was too many locations. And as everyone knows, location, location, location. And the bottom line is that was a lesson learned. And fortunately, through a lot of hard work and effort, we were able to work through that overexpansion, back to consolidation, and the brand moved forward. But the lesson learned there is that infamous or a famous expression, location, 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 and the Wetson stores that were not successful as Wetson's were not successful as Nathan's. And that was a lesson well learned.
From reading the book, too, it was, I think, also a question of cash flow in order to sustain and to actually create the synergies between the Wetson and the Nathan's brand. My guest is Bill Handwerker. He's the grandson of Famous Nathan. And the book he wrote about that is called Nathan's Famous, The First 100 Years, An Unauthorized View of America's Favorite Frankfurter Company. Bill Handwerker, thank you so much for joining me.
My pleasure. And if anyone is interested in getting a hold of me, you can get me on Facebook, Nathan's Famous, The First 100 Years.
Very good. Thank you. StevePomerantz.com now features each week's show in shareable individual segments. Busy at work and want to come back to the show later? No problem. Every segment has a full summary of what was discussed, along with a transcription of the interview. You can read or listen to one of my commentaries. Hey, is there something I mentioned on air you want to find on our site? Well, you can search for it. So check it out and let us know what you think. We'd love to hear your thoughts on what you liked or what you didn't. You can request topics you want us to talk about and ask us questions. We'll get back to you, promise. And you can like us on Facebook, where you'll find out about upcoming events and subscribe to our podcast. It's all there at StevePomerantz.com. That's Steve, PomerantZ.com. This is the Steve Pomerantz Show, and I'm Steve Pomerantz. With the new digital age ever encroaching into our lives, even the art market is changing rapidly. As baby boomers age and then begin to deaccumulate their art, millennials are right behind them, snapping it up in their own unique fashion. To take us into this new art world and its ever-changing landscape, Peter Lowry joins me. Peter is recognized as being the most experienced modern art and design specialist in the auction house industry. He's the director of modern design and fine art at Los Angeles Modern Auctions. And also, you may know him because he happens to moonlight as the modern art authority on PBS's Antique Roadshow. Hey, Peter, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Steve.
So give us some historical context. When did you start in the industry And what was it like back then?
Well, actually, I started very early, almost as a kid. I was 18 and just out of high school, and my older brother had developed a business of selling mid-century modern furniture and 20th century icons of popular culture. Mm-hmm. So I joined him as kind of an intern. And by the time I was 20, I was already developing a kind of a sense of connoisseurship about works made in the 20th century.
So you were initially involved in furniture, right? And you started your own gallery or your own store, right?
Yeah, our original passion was objects. Furniture was a big part of it, but we also sold glass and ceramics and books and jewelry and anything that was made by a 20th century artist or craftsperson that were rejecting classicism and taking avant-garde practices into their medium.
So what, did you eventually sell that business and move into another area of the art world? How did that transition?
No, actually, it's just kind of morphed into a more developed art model. The buyers today are completely different than the buyers back then.
Yeah.
I used to sell to enthusiasts, people who just wanted to surround themselves with these interesting objects and including works of art. But today people are looking more at these objects in the context of investment, as well as nice objects to surround themselves with.
Yeah, I want to get into that, the difference between the baby boomer buying art and, let's say, the millennial market. So baby boomers are more apt to collect for aesthetic reasons, because I guess we're, in a sense, I'm a baby boomer, you know, we were used to buying and having objects, and if they're objects of great beauty, surrounding ourselves with them, as you've said. Millennials have a kind of a different attitude, I think. Maybe they're more into the experience of things rather than owning things. I don't want to put words into your mouth, but I wanted to kind of get that conversation started and see if I'm going down the right path.
Yeah, I think when I started in the mid-80s, I was selling mostly to baby boomers, and they really did want to have an aesthetic experience of sort of acquiring pieces, becoming what they perceived as being a modern day collector of objects that you can use as well as just objects, you know, to surround yourself to enhance your daily life. And over the years, that's kind of morphed, because a lot of this material that was very inexpensive at the time has gone up in value. And you really can't ignore the fact that when you're buying these pieces today, it is an investment.
Yeah.
Investment, because it's one of the biggest, you know, reasons to make a decision. You know, am I going to really buy this dining table that's $45,000 today? Because that's a significant investment. So it's going to take an investment to acquire these pieces today. So you really have to be more cautious and more thoughtful about what you're buying, to make sure that you're buying the works that are continuing to hold their value.
Well, you know, when you're younger and you don't really have the wherewithal to spend a lot of money, then it's kind of art for art's sake, is because you like it. But, you know, if that table was $1,000 30 years ago and now it's at $45,000 and you're going in there going, I'm going to spend $45,000 on this dining room table, you know, there better be another element, or at least question you ask yourself, you know, what is the value of this thing going to be in the future, right?
Yeah, I think, you know, because a more significant portion of your funds are going towards these purchases today, I think. So you have to be cautious and make sure that you're making a wise decision.
One of your ideas that you've written about is one where you think baby boomers, and I mentioned this a little bit in the intro, will be deaccumulating their art over the next 20 years. You think the baby boomers, in a sense, will be out of the art market, and the art market has changed, or the collective psychology has changed, because in other generations, a lot of this art would have been passed down through inheritances, but that may no longer be the case. Can you explain that to us?
So the baby boomers now have been collecting for over 30 years. And if you imagine the arc of a collector, they start collecting when they're in their 30s and 40s. And at some point, those collections need to be disseminated. In the earlier eras, these works were just passed down through the family, like you mentioned, as sort of heirlooms. But today we're seeing collectors and their offspring, you know, have different ideas of what they want to keep and what they want to sell. And sometimes these pieces have gone up so much in value that it really is a strong consideration to consider, you know, the financial value of these works. And so I think we're seeing more baby boomers starting to sell now as they get to that age where transition of their collection is going to be more popular rather than keeping these works together as collections.
Yeah, I guess the idea is that, you know, if in fact you've been fortunate enough to own this art and it's now appreciated greatly, you're going to ask yourself the question, you know, why don't I just sell it now and get the benefit from the value of these things to diversify my financial holdings, maybe do some of the things that I want to do, not knowing, first of all, what the value of this art's going to be, you know, decades from now as tastes and fashion shifts. And maybe the kids really just don't really care for the art anyway, because they have their own sense of style. So if in fact baby boomers are going to be selling off, you know, their art into the marketplace, where are the opportunity for investors there? Because I love to see something that's almost a significant long-term trend. It seems like you could make some investment plans to take that opportunity on that.
Well, I think one important thing that exists now that didn't exist 30 years ago when I started is the readily transfer of information. It's just so much easier to understand what things are worth now than it was 30 years ago.
Yeah.
30 years ago, you really needed to go to an expert, and the expert tended to keep the information to themselves. It wasn't in a dealer's best interest to share that information. So you really never were sure about what something was worth 30 years ago. You only could find out by asking what a dealer was charging for it. Mm-hmm. Today, information is so easy to exchange that almost anyone now can look up the value of works that they're collecting. And there's a whole network of dealers like myself who will share that information for free and very quickly. So that is a unique distinction about the market today as opposed to 30 years ago. And that gives people the option of understanding what things are worth almost on a daily basis.
Yeah.
Almost like you would look up your stock portfolio, you can now look up your art collection portfolio.
Yeah, so there's all this greater transparency, which is a very, very positive outcome of the digital age. I mean, I have personally have bought items online through various auction sites and been very, very happy with the idea that I can buy a David Hockney, who's one of my favorite artists, and know that, you know, it's the real thing, and then have it delivered and then have it framed and have it up in my home. I don't think I really would have done that because I'm a, you know, kind of a low level collector. I wouldn't have done that necessarily 25 or 30 years ago. It would have taken a lot more effort for me to go and start shopping dealers and understanding the market. And as you say, they would keep the information close to the vest. So let's talk about digital. By the way, I'm speaking with Peter Lowry. He's the director of modern design and fine art at Los Angeles Modern Auctions. And you may know him because he also moonlights as the modern art authority on PBS's Antique Roadshow. So Peter, how much has the digital world changed the art market? And tell us now where millennials are headed in this area.
So the digital world has turned the art world upside down. 30 years ago, it was very difficult to get information as a collector. Today, it's very easy. And that means you can be sure of what you're buying, that it's authentic, for example, or B, you know, what it really is worth. You can find out things like prints and multiples and objects that are not unique, but made in multiple. You can find out what other examples have sold for mm-hmm. very easily and very quickly. So you can understand, well, if the last one sold for X, then I feel comfortable paying X for this one.
Yeah.
And that presents the marketplace with a kind of a credible market value that was not seen in previous generations.
Right. So what are millennials buying these days?
So, well, I'm seeing a large group of millennials coming into our auction galleries, and they are looking for investment quality 20th century art and design. And that means that they have a taste for modernism and for contemporary art periods and movements, but they're focusing more on the pieces that have the most value-oriented backgrounds.
What does that mean? Give me an example of that.
If you had a Venn diagram of a circle of all of the things that you like and another circle of all of the things that have tradable, reproducible value, mm-hmm. and you overlap them in some way, you know, where they overlap is where you should be focusing on. That's the advice I give young collectors. Find pieces that you like that are also holding their value and consistently tradable.
Yeah, that's very interesting. Unfortunately, we are out of time. Peter Lowry is with me. You can find him at lamodern.com and also follow him. Are you still working the PBS Antique Roadshow, or was that something you did a few years ago?
No, this is going to be my 15th season coming up.
Oh, wonderful. Congratulations.
Very proud to be associated with the show. It's just an incredible experience.
So you can find more about Peter at lamodern.com. Hey, Peter, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you, Steve.
To hear this conversation again, to find out more about Peter and what he has to say about the art market, don't forget to join the conversation at stevepomerantz.com, P-O-M-E-R-A-N-Z, stevepomerantz.com.
Little boxes on the hillside, little boxes made of ticky-tacky, little boxes on the hillside, little boxes all the same. There's a pink one and a green one and a blue one and a yellow one, and they're all made out of ticky-tacky and they all look just the same.
This is the Steve Pomerantz Show, and I'm Steve Pomerantz. It's time for Real Estate Roundup. This is the time every single week we get together with noted real estate agent Terry Story. Terry is a 29-year veteran with Keller Williams, located in Boca Raton, Florida. Welcome back to the show, Terry.
Thanks for having me, Steve.
So I understand it's tough for millennials out there.
The millennials. It's tough for everyone, Steve.
It is. A little tougher for millennials. Why?
It is. Okay, so here's the deal with the millennials. A lot of them have student debt. Do you realize that the median student debt is $41,000?
Yeah, wow.
That's a lot of money.
It's a lot of money, and it means that if you're paying off your student debt and it's costing you $300, $400 a month, that's less money that you could use either to put down, you could have saved that money, or you can afford on a monthly basis.
That's right. So that's what's really squeezing them.
Mm-hmm.
So that's why it's hard. And then, we've talked about this multiple times. You've got rising interest rates. The pricing of home is going up faster than the incomes.
Yeah.
So all of that combined.
We actually have a stat for that. So between 2011 and 2017, home prices grew 48%, while income for all age groups rose only 15%.
Yeah, so that shows you right there, the squeeze.
The squeeze.
The squeeze.
Yeah. So there's less housing available.
That's right.
So that puts more pressure on, and so prices are rising, interest rates are rising, and if you're burdened with student debt, then kind of severely limit what you can buy.
That's right. And, the median age of a millennial purchasing is 32 years, so that's...
What?
I don't know. I bought mine before 32.
You did? You think that's a little older? No, I think I bought my first house in my early 30s.
Yeah, okay. Yeah. Actually, you know what? Speaking of first-time home buyers, I just did sell homes to first-time home buyers.
Mm-hmm.
And both of them were in their early 30s.
But, I bought a townhouse that I could afford when I was...
Oh, no. You did it wrong.
No, it was a great townhouse. I love this townhouse. But, it was a townhouse with a pool, and it was enough for me.
No, if you wait long enough and you get married and you collect all this money and you buy that first house and you get other people to help you subsidize it,
oh,
it's great.
Oh, I see. So you don't... I don't want to go there. Yeah. All right.
We're in Boca.
Well, no, I get it. So you're saying that there's this big desire to own a house and buying a townhouse is kind of beneath.
In many cases it is from what I see in my marketplace.
Yeah.
But no, absolutely. That's not a bad way to go. Buy something that you can afford, live in it for a few years. Actually, I would suggest if you ever buy something, plan on owning at least 5 years.
Yeah.
So that you have the appreciation to get out of it to cover all your costs.
It's been my experience, though, all those years that I owned townhouses and a house, I never made any money. South Florida was not good for that. And it used to really irk me because people come down from New York and they'd be living in these, three-bedroom, two baths, and it'd be worth $1.5 million.
I know.
They'd come down, they'd buy
and
these
they paid
huge...
$30,000 for it and only owned it 5 years. I've heard all those stories.
Yeah. But they'd come down here and they'd go... It would be like a wonderland for them.
Right.
They'd buy these huge homes for $700,000, which was a fortune to me back then.
Yep.
And they still have $800,000 left over. Why?
And then they retire and they come down live down here. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. All right.
The good old days.
So you've sold to millennials recently. I know you mentioned new home buyers, but what was that experience actually like?
You know, it was so awesome. I love first-time home buyers. You know, they're so energetic and enthusiastic about their home purchase. They're very flexible.
Mm.
Because the inventory levels are so low, I mean, the one customer, he's like, I don't care anymore. Just find me a house.
Uh-huh.
And it's fun and exciting. And then the other couples, you know, same thing. They had been looking for a while. And interestingly enough, I don't know if you're aware of it, but they have these doctor programs. And if you're a doctor, you have special financing. So speaking of the student loan debt, you know, a young doctor coming out of his residency has a ton of debt. And there are special mortgage programs that allow them to obtain a nice size mortgage to buy a nice home because they know that they have the ability to pay back.
Yeah.
And do pay back.
Yeah. Yeah, but the rest of the world does not.
That's just
that.
The doctor program.
Yeah, so be careful when you go and you're sending your kid to school. Make sure they're getting a degree that's monetizable, right?
That's true.
And there's many that are not. So be very cognizant of that, of spending a lot of money for college and coming out with a degree that you can't earn it back.
Right.
Wow. The other thing I wanted to talk about is this idea that people who are buying now are feeling a little bit nervous. And here's what I mean. If you bought back in 2005 when things were churning and they were at their high, there was a lot of excitement in the air. And then, you know, unfortunately, you paid a very high price for it. And of course, then the real estate crash came and
right.
You managed to live through that. Or maybe you went and you started to rent or something of that nature as the years went on. Now we're back. The cycle's gone down. Now its cycles come back up. Prices are at or higher than the levels that were in 2005. And I think some people are thinking, yikes, what if I'm doing this again?
Yeah. And you see that and you sense that a lot of, you know, talking to customers and clients, they anticipate there's going to be a pullback.
Yeah.
And I keep, you know, looking around and saying, well, based on what?
Mm-hmm.
You know, the economy's growing. And we talked about it. It's all about affordability.
Yes.
So, you know, if the prices go up too high, then the interest rates are going to fall because, you know, it's all about supply and demand.
Well, you know, the interest rates are based upon supply and demand in the economy with regards to inflation and the like, not supply and demand in the housing
That's
market
correct.
So much, right? But I get your point. So the idea, though, is that it's a good thing to buy a house. It has a lot of positive characteristics or attributes to it. You're in a stable home. You're in a good neighborhood. You'll make friends. Your kids will make friends and all of that. It has a lot of strong possibilities.
That's right. And home purchases should be long-term investments.
Yeah.
They really shouldn't be, I'm going to buy a house and live in it for 2 years.
Yeah.
It's too expensive. It really should be at least 5 years.
Yeah. And I would not count on capital appreciation. If you get it, good. But
right.
In the meantime, you're paying down your mortgage. And if you stay in long enough, you're going to be building equity. And that building equity is where a lot of people get their wealth.
That's right. There's nothing that says you should turn around and be able to make a profit.
That's right. There's nothing. Remember that, everybody.
Yes.
It's not part of buying a home. It's nice, but it's not necessarily part of buying a home.
That's right.
Okay. My guest, as always, is Terry Story, a 29-year veteran with Keller Williams, located in Boca Raton, Florida, and she can be found at terrystory.com. Thanks, Terry.
Thanks for having me, Steve.
You're listening to The Steve Pomerantz Show. Are you anxious about your financial future? Have you ever made money decisions you've regretted and then repeated the same mistake again? Or perhaps you avoid talking about money altogether? Life is unpredictable, but your decisions don't have to be. And knowing where you stand and having an ongoing action plan will help you get where you want to go. So when you understand that the cornerstone of success is in making good decisions coupled with deliberate action, you can start on the road to ensuring that you're investing the way you should and feel good that you're taking care of yourself and your family in the best possible way. And you know, this has been the mission of the Steve Pomerantz Show from the very beginning. So once again, I want to remind you that you can ask us anything on your mind financially by visiting stevepomerantz.com. And if you have more serious concerns or questions, I'll personally take the time to get back to you to help you find a solution. I've been helping people do just that for 35 years, helping them get ready for retirement, save for a house or college, and so many of life's turning points. So once again, go to stevepomerantz.com and click on Contact. That's stevepomerantz.com.
Investment advisory services are offered through United Capital Financial Advisors, a registered investment advisor. United Capital and the Steve Pomerantz Show are separate and unrelated companies.
This is Steve Pomerantz, and you're listening to the Steve Pomerantz Show. If there is a technological revolution in progress, why are we not seeing the expected benefits for workers? Why aren't we experiencing the benefits from increased productivity, which was expected to raise wages and standards of living? Well, I recently read a well-thought-through article in The Economist magazine about this very subject, and Richard Davies, The Economist's economics editor, is with me today to discuss this. Hi, Richard. Welcome to the show.
Hi, Steve. Thanks very much for having me on.
So there are somewhat troubling circumstances that rich economies find themselves in, maybe a little embarrassing too, for their working populations. We don't seem to be getting those expected benefits from the technology revolution. First of all, what should we be looking for that would convince us that technology is in fact improving our lives?
I think two main things, Steve. The first is increased efficiency in firms. So that would mean that by putting in the same amount of economic input, that could be labor, land, capital, the number of hours worked, firms should be able to produce more. And if we see that, then the second thing we should hope to see is that because workers become more productive, they get some of the gains of that improvement. And practically what we should be seeing is increasing real wages. Mm-hmm. And that's the thing, as you pointed out, that's missing. In America, the median wage has actually been pretty stagnant for the last 40 or so years. And in Britain, similarly, real wages are really going nowhere. This creates a real puzzle for economists.
Yeah, and Italy and Japan saw hardly any increase at all. Germany as well. So it's not just one country in particular. It's really, for the most part, the developed countries, perhaps you could say the rich countries. Is there currently a glut of labor? And if so, what incentive do companies have to actually replace cheap labor with technology?
It's a great question. I mean, it goes back, Steve, to one of the early fears with technology. So if you go back to the early 19th century, textile workers in Britain, in Yorkshire and Lancashire, in the north of England, were very worried that machines that help the mills help make more textiles would actually cut the number of jobs. And so that what they ended up doing is smashing their machines. And that was something that became known as the Luddite movement.
Right.
And in a sense, we have the same kind of fears today, which is that as companies have more computers, they have more machines, are they able to substitute workers for those machines? And because of that, we see rising unemployment, also rising inactivity, which is the state in which workers, they're not looking for work, and they just fall out of the labor market. That's mm-hmm. very worrying. And also a slowdown in real wages. So this is the fear. The fear is that the machines essentially are replacing workers.
Weren't machines supposed to create new industries then?
Indeed, exactly. So again, another economists tend to have a rose-tinted view of innovation. I did give you an example of Luddites in the 19th century.
Right.
But really, that was the kind of early fear. And I guess the classic American example was Henry Ford. Mm-hmm. Before 1913, in Ford's factories making the Model T, the workers would move between the cars. The cars were stationary. So you'd work on the engine, the chassis, the wheels. And that meant that a lot of workers were moving around with a lot of tools. And then in 1914, Ford introduced his assembly line, his famous assembly line, in which the car moves around between the workers because it's hoisted up and it's able to move. And that meant that the time to build the Model T car fell from 12 hours to less than 2 hours. So a massive increase in productivity. But the important point was the second step, which was that Ford was able to pay higher wages than his competitors. And it led to another one of his famous ideas, was that workers had to earn enough to afford his product.
Right.
That's really the hope that economists have, is that productivity leads to these higher wages, and those wages are spent, and that creates new products, creates new industries.
You know, Richard, I was brought up in New York in the 60s, and I lived very close to the New York World's Fair in 1964. And I remember the World's Fair myth of the carousel of progress. Now, you may or may not know what I'm talking about, but it was this idea that productivity, technology would improve our lives. It's more in this line with this rose-tinted view that you say many economists have. Are we brainwashed, or are we just continuing to perpetuate this World's Fair myth?
No, I think that essentially the rose-tinted view or the World's Fair that you mentioned is justified by history. The problem is that, you know, history can change. So much of the economic hope is actually based around British history and the move from agricultural economy to a manufacturing one. So in the 1500s, about 75% of people in Britain were involved in farming and agriculture.
Mm-hmm.
By 1800, it had fallen to around 35%. This was the Industrial Revolution that you hear people talking about. And the point was that that productivity, that big increase in the use of machines in factories, meant that starting in the 1830s, real wages really did rise rapidly, up about 60% in the following 40 years. And this created a big middle class. It created demand for products and so on. So the way that productivity can improve people's lives does have its basis in history. The problem is that this time might be different. We shouldn't always be looking backwards. And there are some signs that the current way that productivity is working is harming some workers.
Well, you know, it brings two questions to mind for me. First of all, you know, all of this is very difficult to predict. The question is there a long lag between the actual creation or the fact that technology would become ubiquitous and the actual benefits from that technological progress?
That's a great, great question, and you've really hit the nail on the head. So going back to that historical example of the Industrial Revolution, actually in the initial years, a bit like the Luddites had, people were very fearful, and there was this sort of period of disruption, and the wage improvements came about 20 years afterwards.
Yeah.
So we might be seeing something like that. I mean, in terms of prediction, I think that's fascinating. It's something that economists at Oxford University, Carl Frey and Michael Osborne, have done a lot of work on. So they've been analyzing which jobs are at risk of being automated and which ones aren't. They've got two really interesting findings. The first is that this risk of automation is really common. So everybody should know about it and kind of be prepared for it. In the breakdown of jobs that people, for example, at the Bureau of Labor Statistics here in the States use, they reckon that around half of those categories of jobs are at risk of automation by machine.
Half of the jobs,
around 47%.
Are at risk of being eliminated because of machines.
Exactly.
Okay.
And the second is that it's not just low-skilled jobs. So the Oxford academics predict that things like accountancy, legal work, flying airplanes, for example, these are typically middle-class and higher-paying jobs, are actually quite at risk. And that some jobs that are slightly more lowly paid, for example, hairdressers and firefighters, actually those jobs are very hard to automate. So actually this is something that's going to affect a lot of workers, and it's going to affect workers right across the distribution of skills and of earnings.
My guest is Richard Davies. He's the Economist's economics editor, and I'm referring to an article that was written in The Economist about technology. Is it working? Are we getting the productivity out of technology that we have all come to expect? There's also the thought that these new technologies that we're experiencing today, this automation, this high information availability in our smartphones and so on, these technologies are actually less transformative than the old technologies which we're referring to, the electrification of the world, the invention of cars, and also of wireless communications. Is it possible that while these are very exciting and lead to a real wow factor, maybe they're just not having the same effect as those older innovations?
Of course, that's entirely possible. One of the problems with economics in general is that we have to use the past as our kind of experimentation lab. We can't really conduct economic experiments. So we look to history. and history can change. But it could be that this third technological revolution is different to the previous ones. And there are some signs of that. So, for example, a lot of the things that people are making are technological improvements, but are essentially free products. So if we think of things like apps, many of the things that people have on their smartphone. So take a concrete example from here in New York, the taxi market and Uber.
Yeah.
Now, Uber is a free app. It's free to me on my phone. It makes the taxi, for me as a user of taxis, it makes the market work better.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not paying anything extra. In fact, I'm paying less. On the other side of the market, the taxi drivers are having to work harder. There's more of them competing. Now, that does increase the overall size of the market. But for all taxi drivers who are in plentiful supply now that Uber is around, they are at risk of seeing their wages go down because the skills that they have are not really scarce anymore.
Yeah.
And that's the key problem.
We're starting to see the price erosion of the taxi medallion, which is what is required for a taxi to operate in the city of New York. You have to have this medallion. And some prices for these medallions, they have become very valuable in the past because of scarcity. And some of them go for $1 million. But I did read an article recently how the price seems to be coming down. So in effect, that's reinforcing what you're saying, is that taxis really aren't making as much money. It's harder. So it's a disruptive technology. And we're seeing that a lot really everywhere in almost all industries. Medicine, can a robot replace a surgeon to some degree? But we're also seeing tremendous innovations in biotechnology that were impossible just a few years ago. And the whole healthcare industry is a burgeoning industry. Is the healthcare industry an exception or maybe an example of how jobs are shifting because of this new technology?
I think it's an example. It's the expenditure on healthcare is increasing so rapidly in the US, but also in Britain because of demographic aging, essentially. And it's a great example, in fact. I think you really hit the nail on the head when you talked about scarcity and taxi drivers and the medallion. So what we've seen there, if we think about what a taxi driver is doing, he's picking you up and he or she is providing two services, essentially. One is to know where they're going to drive you because they know the city. And the second is to drive you there. What the disruption does is that essentially the computer and the GPS system is telling the driver how to get from A to B,
mm-hmm.
and that just leaves the driver doing the driving. Now that, simply driving a car, is something that's plentiful, it's not scarce. And if there's a sort of iron rule from microeconomics, it's that scarce things have higher prices and more common things have lower prices. And to take it into healthcare, I think the Uber example is interesting. There are new services, for example, that let you, on your smartphone, call a medical practitioner. There are new types of medical practitioners that are sort of mobile, that will come to your home, give you an assessment, and so on. It's essentially the same technology, but because the scarcity question is different, so medical practitioners are scarce, the side of the market there dealing with demand, as I said, because of demographic shifts, because of the aging population, demand is very strong. So if you're selling a scarce product into a strongly growing market, then the technology actually benefits you massively. And I think this really illustrates one of the perhaps worrying things about the new technological revolution, which is that it's the sort of winners and losers story. Some people mm-hmm. are going to gain a lot and others are going to lose out.
Well, it's ironic to me that a hairdresser will probably not lose his or her job, but a lawyer may, which brings up the question of the standard college education today. Do you have any conclusions based upon the value of a college education in this changing environment?
Yes, I think that college education is going to be absolutely essential. Of course, there are going to be some jobs, sort of artisanal jobs, things like hairdressing, maybe making bespoke furniture,
mm-hmm.
these kind of things, which machines really can't compete.
Yeah, made-to-order furniture.
Exactly.
Yeah.
That kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
So if you're not the sort of person who enjoys reading and writing and people want to work with their hands, that kind of stuff, there are still going to be jobs out there that you really need to specialize and essentially get back to that point of making something scarce. For the majority of people, though, the best option is to invest as much as possible in their education. because that means you're going to end up being one of these workers who, rather than competing with the machine, is using the machine.
You know, my own industry has undergone a lot of changes. I'm in the investment advisory industry, and technology has basically commoditized so many aspects of the investment advisory business. One part of that that I've always tuned into is that a person with experience and understanding cannot be commoditized. Experience cannot be commoditized. And yet, there are some new technologies out there which offer a very technological approach to money management using all the latest algorithms available about asset allocation and the like. And is this big question in the advice industry too, is the business of an individual advisor going to go away and be replaced by machinery? We only have about a minute left, Richard. What's your thought on that?
I think that ultimately the question is no. And in brief, I'll give you a quick example. If you put in to an algorithm all the things that investment professionals tend to look at, you know, earnings, potential for future earnings, stock splits, all that kind of stuff, potential for dividends, it's going to tell you that some leading emerging markets, for example, Brazil and Russia, look really low priced. They look like they're sort of screaming buy.
Yeah.
But you really need the investment professional to look at the political situation and to really ask, is it now a good time to be investing in kind of risky emerging markets? Mm-hmm. And I think most people are thinking no. So I think that the most likely thing is that combination. You can do your number crunching if you work in finance much more quickly. You can actually, if you spend enough time to get your algorithm right, you can get the computer to sort of spit out a few suggestions for you, saving you time, you know, playing around with your spreadsheet.
Mm-hmm.
But actually, the decision, which requires experience, which requires wider things that the computer is not going to be looking at, that needs to be taken by a human being.
Well, I find this all incredibly fascinating, and I hope my listeners have as well. My guest is Richard Davies. He's the Economist's economic editor. And by the way, if you're interested in really understanding how things work and what's going on in the world, I do recommend The Economist. Richard, thank you so much for spending your time with me.
My pleasure. Thank you, Steve.
I'd like to take a moment to thank all the people involved in the making of this show. Senior producer Erica Stamolo, engineer Brian Zykowitz, senior editor Carol Melzone, and John Sova, who handles our digital platform, and of course, finally, contributor Terry Story. Any interviewee's appearance on the Steve Pomerantz Show does not represent any endorsement or confer any opinion whatsoever, either positive or negative, by the Steve Pomerantz Show or any media by which the Steve Pomerantz Show is distributed. Thank you so much for joining us.
Investing involves risk, and listeners should carefully consider their own investment objectives and never rely on any single chart, graph, or marketing piece to make decisions. The radio show is intended for informational purposes only, is not a recommendation to buy or sell any securities, and should not be considered tax, legal, investment advice. Please contact your tax, legal, financial professional with questions about your specific needs and circumstances. The information in the show is obtained from sources believed to be reliable. However, their accuracy and completeness cannot be guaranteed. All data are driven from publicly available information and has not been independently verified by United Capital. Neither United Capital nor any of its affiliates makes any representation or warranty as to the accuracy or completeness of the information contained in this recording, and any liability as a result of this recording is expressly disclaimed. This recording should not be relied upon to evaluate any potential transaction. United Capital is not giving tax, legal, investment advice by means of this recording, and this recording does not establish a client relationship with United Capital.